This is a podcast of the Political Ecology Forum at Norwegian University of Life Sciences. Visit politicalecology.space.
Okay, welcome everyone. This is the first interview of a series to be produced by the Political Ecology Forum at NMBU with the objective of disseminating the outstanding work of researchers adhered to the forum. Today we have John Andrew McNeish, who recently published Sovereign Forces, Everyday Challenges to Environmental Governance in Latin America, published by Bergen Books. Welcome, John. Thanks for joining.
Thank you very much.
A few days ago, I had the opportunity to participate in the book launch. John had three commentators, and the event was in Oslo, and it was a very nice event, and with very interesting comments from the panel and the audience. And I would like to begin the conversation, John, just by with a personal note, that saying that as someone who's beginning an academic path, it was for me your book like a good example of how an academic career builds up, because I got the impression that throughout your career, one set of questions that you had initially, taking you to Bolivia, I believe it was first, they take you to this context, you accumulated experiences, and then those insights you like took you to a different context with different questions, and like the process kept going on to Guatemala, Colombia, and so on. And now you are in a position where you kind of look back to those experiences and extract like a different, you approach a different phenomenon, in this case, sovereignty. Yes. So that was a very interesting lesson for me to see how what I might be looking at now as a PhD student at NMBU might become a different question in the future, as if other people like me experience this different research contexts. So I wanted to ask you if you can share a bit more about how you experienced this process, if this narrative that I just tried to lay down is corresponds with what you experienced.
It does correspond. Yeah, thanks. So Sovereign Forces, it's a book that deals with the relationship between natural resource governance and particularly natural resource contestations and this question of sovereignty. That is, who owns or who has the right to those natural resources. It is an attempt to also explore the idea of sovereignty and to really demonstrate that sovereignty is something that is a process, that is an idea that is constantly under work. And as an idea that's constantly under work, it's also constantly under contestation. It's a book as well that I never, 20 years ago, when I was doing my own PhD, I never intended to write a book of this nature. It wasn't even an inkling in my mind. It was not an idea that I had at all, no notion of whatsoever. At that time, during my PhD, I was working on ideas around participation and participatory development from a very anthropological angle, looking at the way in which reforms in Bolivia back in the 1990s impacted state-community relations and therefore also impacted as well the abilities of people to participate or not participate in development. And so this idea of working on sovereignty was just not part of that story whatsoever. But over the years, I've worked and found myself working increasingly with not only questions around participation in politics, but also the relationship of that to questions of natural resource governance. And I've had the opportunity, as a result of research grants, which have been won together with other colleagues, as a result as well of being very well accepted as well by, I would say, a whole series of local researchers and local institutions in Latin America, had great opportunity to move between contexts and learn quite deeply about this relationship, really, between questions of participation in politics and questions of natural resource governance. And it's over that time that I've understood that maybe there is something to be said about that relationship, which also is a comment, actually, a commentary on sovereignty. And so that's built over a long period of time. And it's built, as the book reveals as well, between different spaces. And so it brings together work that I've done for my PhD in Bolivia, together with work that I've also done for postdoctoral work that I did in Guatemala, and then also work that I've done later on as well in Colombia. And so it's a reflection, the book is very much a reflection on those different spaces, but also not only what's different about them, but also looking at also kind of some common dynamics that can be identified in relationship to the way in which sovereignty has been formed and the way in which contested sovereignty impacts on the governance of natural resources, and particularly the way in which sovereignty connects as well to contexts of not only contestation, but actually can be also an explanatory factor for quite severe violence in some contexts. That's particularly the case in Colombia and perhaps also in Guatemala, but it actually is a common feature, I would say, as well, of the entire region of Latin America, based on the experience at least that I have.
How did you approach that quality of having like a fragmented stories that approach they would seem fragmented or distant, not only geographically, but the connections are not so clear. You make them clear through the book. So how was that process of taking that quality that could be a weakness and making them a strength?
So, I mean, I never carried out, you know, this big project, as I've said, is not a reflection of a defined research project. I mean, I've worked on many defined research projects in the past, and there are publications that have to do with those specific projects. This is not that kind of work. And I knew that when I was writing the book that many of my colleagues would have expected me to write something that was much more of a classical ethnography, the reflection or the narrative and exploration of the experience of doing research in one place on one issue in one moment of time. And I realized that actually that I wasn't able to do that, because this wasn't material that I'd just collected at one point. And I also realized that maybe there was actually a strength to doing something different for once, a form of comparative ethnography, something that doesn't really exist. There is, we know something that we can call comparative politics, where there are, you know, political scientists for a long time have kind of compared distinct systems of governance and distinct systems of politics between countries. There's a great tradition for that within political science. In my disciplinary background as an anthropologist, there's no tradition for that. In fact, that would be very much questioned as something that would be strong at all. So I wanted to test that. I wanted to test out really my own disciplinary background and see if there might be some value in actually carrying out what we could call comparative ethnography, where through deep dives in each of these locations and each of these moments of time, there are not only the abilities to talk about specifics, the specifics of context, the specifics of society and cultural development, or even state development, but also look as well at the, you know, comparatively to look and see whether there might also be some similar dynamics, some dynamics that also unite these countries as part of a regional system on the one hand, but also as part as well part of the global system. One of the great failures, at least of work that's done on regions, like on Latin America or in Africa, very often is that they're only referential to the region. They're not referential to broader processes in terms of global dynamics. So I wanted to carry out something that was different. At the same time, you will see as well that there's a reflection in the introduction to the book about the fact that a lot of the material I put together is rather accidental, in the sense it's material that I've collected along the way, or reflections I've collected along the way that never found their way into other publications, but over time recognized, in fact, that there were a series of dots that could be joined together. And that some of this information is information that wasn't just, you know, it wasn't the focus of research. It were, as I've even, you know, described in the book, it's there are the things that happen out of the corner of my eye. There are interviews that happen or don't happen as a result of circumstances. Some research efforts don't turn out the way I had intended them to be. I start in one place and realize that there's something more important going on in another place. and that's just part of the experience of doing research. And there's some, you know, that's not only important in terms of thinking about the way in which this book has been put together as what we might call a patchwork. It's also important of thinking about research dynamics over time as well, and recognizing that research isn't always about the, you know, the best outcome. It's not only about the successful research effort, but sometimes the negative experiences of research or the things that don't work out actually in the end actually mean something. And there's something to take with us. And I was thinking about when I was writing that introduction, I was thinking about the importance of that, for example, with regards to master's students or PhD students or postdoctoral students or postdoctoral candidates, in the sense that you shouldn't just give up because things get difficult, and you shouldn't just give up because things go sideways. Sometimes things going sideways also reveal new things that you hadn't thought about before, and maybe also transform the project into something that's perhaps more interesting at the end of the day.
Yeah, I do. I did get that sense of something building up that was not intentional from the beginning, and that was pretty enlightening for me, at least. Okay, I want to jump to the topic or the concept of sovereignty as a concept, because I think that the book offers a very comprehensive history of the concept. And at least for me, before reading the book, and I think for many people out there, especially in Latin America, like when we hear about sovereignty, like it reminds me of the president or something that national leaders of the nation state would use as a category very fundamental to our foundational myths. But the book also offers a comprehensive history of, well, the category. But also it demonstrates, I think, very convincingly how it is useful to actually understand the present and not only as a narrative tool for nation states. But do you think the idea of sovereignty has a promising future for analytical and also for pragmatic purposes?
Yeah, in both accounts, I think that it does have a promising future, but only a promising future if we can also provide a critique of it. I mean, as I've tried to argue through the book, it is an idea that is in formation and constant formation and transformation. It is an idea that is not only agreed upon at moments, but it's also an idea that is constantly disagreed on as well. And so it's an idea that has to be built and rebuilt over time as an expression as well of really the sort of encompassment of various populations' ideas of who they are as a nation, who they are as a people, who they are, what their government represents and what their government can do for them. And so claims around being a nation state or claims about being a nation, these are claims that are not something that's set in stone. They're something to be analyzed, critiqued. And I think we all have to understand that they're dynamic and quite fluid. There's everything to play for. There's everything that's possible still with this. And that maybe is, I got one of the comments from my colleagues in the book launch was that I was overly optimistic. But I'm optimistic because these things are actually in flux. The game's not over. There is a possibility of transformation and betterment over time, despite the fact that the book also describes, you know, quite horrific experiences as well of violence and, structural failure. You know, despite that, there is everything still to play for. There's an opportunity here as well. So the book is very much an exploration of sovereignty as an idea, and its testing as well through empirical examples, empirical cases. And it's a book, I think, that demonstrates that classical notion of sovereignty that many, I think, have. And just as the kind of the popular understanding, the encyclopedia explanation of what sovereignty means as control, mm-hmm. a state's control over a defined territory, and that the state operates as a sovereign body in relation to that defined territory. That notion is something that is incorrect. It's actually been incorrect for a long time as well. This idea of sovereignty is not something that has just been reformulated in the current moment. It's something that's been reformulated, in fact, through a very long history as well. A history of, on the one side, European state formation, on the other hand, a whole experience as well of colonialism, and the failures as well of colonialism to stretch to the boundaries, to really reach and also kind of reach a common agreement as well with the peoples that have been colonized. And so, you know, we see in this history, in fact, that sovereignty very clearly is something that's not stable. It's something that's constantly being reworked, in fact.
And, but what is it that you like about the term or the history of the term? I ask this because it seems that like you could make this conceptual construction using a different word, but related to this comment that about like there's some optimism in the text, it seems to me that there's something that you like about the word that it's that justifies like this trying to vindicate the concept and give a new meaning, a new critical meaning to it.
So it's not necessarily a word or an idea that I particularly like. It's not like it's a sense of kind of personal likes or dislikes, but it's a concept that I think is omnipresent. It's a concept that we can't escape. And so if we look at not only European history, but also world history and the history of Latin America, it's a concept that cannot be escaped. I mean, there is, you know, as a result of a whole history of colonialism, and particularly settler colonialism, you know, this idea, the notion of the state and the notion also of sovereignty is something that worked its way in to the histories of all places. So the state is something that we can't really, and its claims about sovereignty is not something that we can escape. But similarly also, what we can't escape is also the possibility to question that. And so when we look at world history, and look at, for example, the fall of colonialism, the fall of imperial power, and the reconstitution as well of different peoples as nations in the post-colonial period, we constantly see as well that sovereignty is something that is being reworked, and reworked in a hope, at least, that it provides a concept that is fit for purpose. And I think that history is also quite telling of an optimism in the sense that it's still possible to rework the concept as well to make it something fit for purpose. I think there is an argument to be made, you know, maybe an anarchist argument to be made that we should maybe just get rid of the concept entirely. But I think that actually is also very difficult to do given the pathways, given the deep kind of scoring that has been left behind by state formation and state structures. And so even in the act of reformulating something other than the state, we would be constantly referring to the state and to sovereignty in that regard.
Yeah, it reminded me that, I'm quite familiar with some components of the like the ethics of liberation and liberation theology. And I remembered when I was reading your text, it kept reminding me of this, like putting upside down the idea of sovereignty that some Latin American scholars in this tradition of liberation ethics used to portray, like ask the question, who's the sovereign? And well, in liberation theology, is like the marginalized should be the main sovereign, and then from the marginalized you go up, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's, well, it sounds to me at least like a quite revolutionary or novel or attractive idea, because you're not giving away the idea like in an anarchist argument kind type
no.
of thing, but it's quite powerful, I think.
Well, it's a reflection of experience as well, of working with communities, and a reflection of an experience of working with social movements and political movements who have been very much, you know, movements from below, or communities who have fought their marginalization, of working with indigenous peoples, of working with social, you know, social movements representing peasant organizations, or representing people who are human rights activists, environmentalists, etc., etc. So that very much is, you know, my argument is very much an empirical argument in the sense that it reflects as well an experience of working with organizations like that who see the state in that way, who see the state as something that they have to engage with, because without it, they you know, conditions would even only get worse. They've had bloody experiences of revolution, of rebellion, etc. And it got them somewhere, but it didn't get them far enough. And so they constantly are required to somehow go back to the state, go back as well to a discussion, a dialogue, albeit a militant dialogue, about the notion of sovereignty. So this is, you know, the book is very much a reflection of that very, you know, clear empirical experience as well over many, many years.
Yeah, maybe I would like to say that it gave me this image that sovereignty as something, to retrieve a concept from other frameworks, that sovereignty as something polycentric that has different sources.
Yeah, that I would
and
agree with.
They all can be legitimate in their own way, mm-hmm. but it's difficult to find like a harmonizing relation between these inside this network. But then that takes me to another discussion that I kept connecting with your text, which is the concept of autonomía in Spanish, or autonomy, which I'm now thinking like more with my in reference to the Mexican context, where the Zapatista movement, for example, has adopted this concept of autonomía as like their main proposal to the world. But it seems to me that now comparing your treatment of sovereignty and Zapatista autonomy, I would think of autonomía as that a kind of sovereignty that comes from below, and that at some point in their discourse, at least, it kind of rejects other sources of, or delegitimizes other sources of sovereignty. So my question there for you is, do you think there is anything new to, or something that your conception of sovereignty can contribute to this conception that Zapatismo in Mexico, for example, has about the autonomía or sovereignty from below?
I mean, I think the concept of autonomy is really important, but autonomy also is a very spatial understanding, or it's a spatial geographical political understanding. And perhaps what I've been expressing through my book, and also emphasizing this idea of resource sovereignty, is an idea where we're not just talking about geography or the material in terms of the material of land, but we're also talking about a world, a realm of ideas, a realm of ontologies, a realm of beliefs as well about the world. And so perhaps what I'm trying to do in the book then is to bracket together a classical understanding of a very classical material understanding of geography and land and territory, together with an idea that's perhaps more anthropological, in the sense of a recognition as well that land is also not only an economic expression or a spatial or scalar representation, but it's also something that is deeply spiritual, that's deeply embedded in people's beliefs, and deeply embedded as well in their conceptions of who they are as people. In fact, there is no separation between many of these populations and the land in which they live.
Which, related to that, I also thought that it was nice to see in your text that I don't felt like you were falling into the romanticizing these different ontologies, because at some point in the text and also in the book launch, you mentioned that even though someone with a set of beliefs that you would not classify as Western beliefs, he or she can have those a different cosmology, but that does not prevent that person from working in a mine, for example, and we can also think of ourselves as people, for example, working in a university, also reluctantly engaging with systems that we don't We would like them to be different, but those contradictions are there. So you don't fall into that romantic.
Some of the writing, and not only in anthropology but actually in the social sciences on ontology, some of the writing is overly polarizing, of making contrasts between, you know, supposedly very distinct worlds. But unfortunately, history doesn't allow for that. History, in the way in which history has occurred, as a result of colonialism, the formation as well of empires, the way in which globalization has also taken place in terms of linking up also economic systems from one place and the other, the way in which as well that you know, the marginal spaces or remote places have also been somehow over time linked, either directly or have been at least touched on, have been somehow influenced by the outside world, requires therefore an understanding that there is no purity in the sense, there's no clear contrast in terms of the way in which people can see the world. As a result of that, I think that, you know, my experience at least of working with these communities is that they, and of course I'm only, some may argue against this, but I'm only working with certain communities that, you know, in these countries, Colombia, Guatemala, and Bolivia, these are communities who, in my experience, on the one hand, have, yes, a very strong sense of connection to the natural environment, a deep spiritual connection, a deep ontology about the relationship between themselves as people and their communities with the land, but also at the same time, also a very deep experience, a deep historical experience of international capital, the way in which globalization over time has impacted on their lives and abilities to decide on who they are and where they go and what futures they have. And so as a result of that, you know, we find people who pragmatically have to make decisions, where on the one hand, yes, they venerate the natural world, but in order to just get by, they also have to take part in processes and practices perhaps which are damaging to the natural world. Or there are ways in which they use culture as well to placate, in the hope that they can placate as well the damage that they're doing to the natural world. And so the whole tradition really, although it very strong, comes forward very strongly actually in Andean, highland Andean communities, relationships to the land and the way in which they engage in, for example, mining at different scales, both forms of cooperative mining, but also more large scale mining, is that they bring with them their traditions into the mine as a way of placating those forces of nature, a way of re-establishing their relationships to nature, at the same time as recognizing as well that the world has been severely impacted or transformed as a result of these forces of capital, these forces of money, these forces of extraction. And there's a great history, in fact, I'm not the only one to write about this, there's a great history of anthropology writing on these very issues. And so, I mean, certainly when I was studying anthropology, that was a time when we, of course, were all encouraged to read people like Michael Taussig and June Nash and Olivia Harris and so on and so forth. And so this is nothing new in a way. I guess, what I'm doing in the book is just reminding people that that's the case.
Mm-hmm. I remember one time I was driving a car in the south of Mexico, in the state of Campeche, talking to a leader of a community, and he was telling me about like how he understood the ecosystem services. They were receiving money from the government under this framework, and he had like a very ontological strong argumentation. But he was eating, he was drinking Coke from a bottle. And at some point, as he was making his argument of Mother Earth and nature and why is that so important, suddenly he threw away the can. Or the bottle. And I was like really confused. Like, is he just using the discourse to... Because he knows I used to work in that NGO at that moment, so at that moment my reaction was like, no, this discourse is just false. But then I thought maybe it's not, it's just that he's not making the same connections that I'm assuming that he should have. So I think that's interesting also in your book.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that there is a lot of stereotypes which are formed as well of different peoples around the world and how they act. And when they don't act like that, we're disappointed. Mm-hmm. But why should they act any differently to us? I mean, we do these things. We have these.
Yeah.
We live by contradiction as well. You know, I live in a country here in Norway, a country that deeply respects the natural environment and celebrates it in a great fashion, right? It's a part of all of our national imaginaries and a part of all of our, the artistic kind of representations of the country. It's part of our daily culture to go walks in nature and to talk about how beautiful the world is and about how untouched the Norwegian nature is. But we're also an oil producer. We're also a country that have built our wealth on the back of oil production. We're also a society that is highly consumeristic. I mean, we are one of the nations in the world that have an extremely high level of consumption of all goods, in fact, and particularly of energy. We're, on top amongst those on top in terms of levels of consumption. And we're also a society that are also give birth to wonderful ideas such as deep ecology. So all of these contrasts are there in all societies. And I think that what we should do is give pause to, the stereotypes that we create of the other and recognize that actually they've been through it's of course, the context matters and specific historical experiences matter. But there are also global experiences, and one of the clearly global experiences as well has been also this experience of colonialism, of globalization, economic globalization, and even in the spaces of autonomy. Those spaces of autonomy are also limited, unfortunately, as well, because on the outer edge of that space of autonomy, there is also the operation of international capital. So even the Zapatistas, I have great respect for the experiment that has been carried out by the Zapatistas and by other communities who've tried to do something similar in terms of creating autonomous spaces. But those autonomous spaces are nonetheless limited. They have their limits, and beyond those limits, there exists international capital and globalization. And that's constantly pressing on the autonomy. It's constantly pressing on their abilities as well to express themselves within their autonomous spaces, and it actually also governs actually what kinds of expression they can make. So the Zapatistas can, on the one hand, they can live as they want within their autonomous space, it would appear, but only so far. If they, for example, if there are certain aspects that would be judged to be unacceptable by international capital or unacceptable by the international community in terms of international, international kind of liberal democratic system, there would be intervention. And we also see that as well happening.
Yeah. But then that takes me to the next topic, which is like, okay, granting that there's like this polycentric network of sovereignties legitimized in their own context. But then on the other hand, we have like these global challenges like climate change or biodiversity loss, things that it's hard to imagine how solutions can be... cannot be global solutions that require like a coordination of big actors and small actors at the same time. Mm-hmm. So doesn't that gives you like some reasons for pessimism, having like this polycentric ultra complex network of sovereignties and the need for these global solutions?
So the argument I make in the book isn't just about polycentricity. It's not just about pluralism. It's also although I'm acknowledging that there are different interests, I'm not saying that all of those interests are necessarily equal. And we have to recognize that many of those interests around, these expressions of resource sovereignty, some of those expressions of resource sovereignty are violent and clearly also not beneficial for either local society or national society or global society. There are expressions of sovereignty which are very clearly damaging. And for example, organized crime. For example, illegal actors or illegal armed actors such as paramilitary organizations. These are expressions also of sovereignty. They actually are making also, they're contesting the understanding of the state. They're contesting also sovereignty through what they're doing. And they clearly that means that they are, you know, these are expressions which are really problematic. They are not to be put at the same level as perhaps other expressions of sovereignty, which are looking for peace, looking for inclusivity of people within democratic process, which are also taking care of the natural environment. The book is called, you know, Sovereign Forces, Everyday Challenges to Environmental Governance, for a reason, because it is also about how do we reach also a pact on environmental governance? How do we reach, you know, a better understanding of the management and use of natural resources in a way which is more beneficial to those that rely or live with in the space of where those natural resources are coming from? One of the concerns as well, quite clearly in the book as well, is with peace. The communities that I work with, that ultimately one of the major concerns that they have is actually just finding a way of living in peace, being left alone by armed actors, left alone by those that are corrupt, either corrupt state officials, government officials, or left alone by private corporations who act on their spaces of life and encroach on their spaces of life and reduce their autonomy.
I have a question precisely on how to approach organized crime, or by now I don't even know how to define them, because I recently read a book that has a title, Cartels Don't Exist, which is like, I think in the book launch there was a comment about, like, how can you talk about states when it's very difficult to point that this is the state?
Yeah.
And which is a valid and interesting argument. But using that same idea with drug cartels, it's also very compelling, because, by acknowledging that thing that we call drug cartels are like a network that is embedded in the state and sometimes in grassroots movements. And I was thinking also, as you already said, drug cartels have control over territories. They have resources to attempt to buy politicians at all levels. But at the same time, I think for a big cartel, it's even better to have a functional state that can make the business profitable instead of using resources to fight other small cartels. And in that sense, I'm not like quite sure of what kind of sovereignty organized crime or how to classify the claims of or what drug cartels are trying to achieve. Is that a sovereign actor? It seems to me that you say yes already, but can you expand a bit more?
Well, first of all, not all Latin American states have the same problems, right? So some certainly have more problems with organized crime than others, and some states and state structures are perhaps more separated away from the influence of illegal actors than others. And so there are some standalone examples, of course, of countries that which really have severe problems with this. Mm-hmm. Your own home country of Mexico, we would also, of course, talk about Colombia, we could talk about Guatemala. There are other countries we could talk about as well, that have severe problems with this. But it's not correct to tar all of these countries with the same brush. They are there are distinctions, and we should absolutely recognize that. So having said that, in terms of whether these are, illegal actors, whether they are actors, making claims on sovereignty, I think very clearly, yes, they are making claims on sovereignty. They're making claims on land, and they're also making claims as well on who controls that land, who the resources belong to. They make claims as well about what is the correct form as well of governance. Not only within distinct territories, but also very often at the level of the nation state. They clearly compete as well with state forces and state government in terms of not only controlling and having, the control of force in a particular region, but they actually also compete with state authorities in terms of the provision as well of assistance to these to local communities. I mean, it's been very interesting, for example, during the pandemic, you know, that we have drug cartels in Mexico who end up being the ones who are providing, you know, health supplies to local communities, or providing food when food wasn't arriving, or and so on. And we have find similar things also taking place in other countries where cartels are very strong actors. And of course, in, you know, we also know that in some contexts as well, the cartels have been celebrated as being representing more efficient government than their national government or their local government. And so for that reason, you have, you know, have you still have, for example, neighborhoods such as in Medellin that celebrate, Arturo Escobar, you know, as a leading figure in the country's politics. So there's a sort of a curious notion where he becomes a representation of good governance in a certain space. So that, yeah, there is an argument to be made then that cartels and illegal actors do have actually sovereign claims. I don't have a very simple, there's no solution given in the book as to how to easily deal with them. There is no simple solution, I think, to deal with them, particularly given that, as I've, you know, as I do give indication, is that there is sometimes difficulty to actually even put to even sort of distinguish between the cartels or the legal actors rather, and state officials or state actions. And very often states, you know, in certain states at least, that there, you know, the system has become entirely corrupted or rotten at this, you know, at the roots, as it were. And there's been a lot of written about that, for example, in Mexico. I mean, in terms of the way in which leading families in Mexico and the leading families of the cartels are in fact intermarried. Not even that, you know, we can also find intermarriage as well between these two different groups, the cartels and politicians, and also the military. So there's also a military, you know, a third part of this as well, which is also to be recognized. So to be able to deal with those relationships is extremely difficult. And I don't really have a simple answer for that. But what I do try to say is that that if there is a serious effort to deal with questions of natural resource governance, that those efforts of natural resource governance have to respond to the multiplicity of expressions of resource sovereignty. They have to be worked through. How they work through, I don't give any easy answers to that. All I'm saying is that they do have to be worked through, and worked through seriously, and worked through in a way which they haven't been so far. You know, and if they're not worked through, all essentially we will see is a continuance of the same kind of problematics, the same violence, the same destruction of the environment that we've seen over the last for many decades in Latin America. If there's to be an opportunity for change, if there's an opportunity for a change in direction in terms of environmental management, then these varying expressions of sovereignty have to be taken seriously. They have to come together. And there has to be also kind of a sorting out of, well, what is of benefit? What is of benefit to the natural environment, but also what is of benefit to those people, those communities that live with that natural environment or live as part of that natural environment?
In that sense, when the book explores the different processes of consultation, of prior consultation, it was very informative also for me, coming from a context in where now we have like consultations on big mega projects propelled by self-defined left-wing government. It was quite a release to see, okay, many other countries in the same region have experienced something very similar. And I was wondering if you can think of guidelines or like some principles about how prior consultations should be done right, like some key aspects to consider, how to avoid states or corporate interests to kind of fetishize these instruments of participatory democracy.
I mean, a lot of this is very much to do with just actually applying regulation as is stated, you know, or applying law as has been designed. Unfortunately, the experience of multiple countries and multiple efforts as well at prior consultation have been actually that the rules and the regulations have been circumvented. They've been twisted, manipulated out of shape. Yeah. And that's happened in both countries that are left-leaning and countries that are right-leaning. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. They're all doing the same thing. Basically, they're all talking about, you know, the importance of consultation and participation, and then actually not delivering that consultation and participation. So there are, you know, so there are actually very few examples of good consultations out there. And it's interesting that that's the case, because, you know, the laws and regulations would give indication that this was now, you know, now things were, should be sorting themselves out, and they're not. And so you have to ask questions about why is that not the case? Why are we not sorting the, you know, these problems out, given that we have regulations and laws that should govern this? And it has a lot to do with the way in which, unfortunately, these societies have been formed, or rather the way in which states, the states have been formed in these countries as a result of a history of settler colonialism, where there are still very, very deeply ingrained expressions of racism and xenophobia, where there is a notion that only one way of life is good and all other ways of life are backward or unacceptable. And that is really the cause as well of a division, you know, being made in terms of these laws and regulations, where basically the laws and the regulations are defined and used, you know, they're used by those in power as they see fit, or ignored as they see fit. And that clearly is unacceptable, and clearly also delivers very poor results in terms of all these processes of consultation. It basically means what they're doing so far is not serious. And communities know this. You know, the communities that I've worked with in these countries know very well that what's going on here is a process of manipulation, where they're being, it's a form of theater where they're being asked to come and, you know, take part in dialogue and consultation, only to find that, in fact, the dialogue and consultation leads nowhere other than what was already pre-decided, that the project would go ahead. And for that reason, there is a great level of frustration amongst these communities. And for that reason as well, that they look then also at other possibilities in terms of basically securing their territory, whether it be through the courts, through other legal action, whether it through also be other through other political mechanisms, you know, democratic political mechanisms that exist in terms of using local politicians and mounting campaigns and so on, carrying out also forms of popular votes and referenda, or also taking to more militant action, which of course they also should have a democratic right to, which is to go out in the street and also, you know, use placards and their own voice to express their disgust by the fact that these consultations are not functioning the way they are said to function. So, the way to improve these consultations are actually pretty clear. It's just about, very often it is just about applying the regulations, applying the law as is stated. And then beyond that, it is also, of course, about providing spaces which are far more participatory and deliberative, where there is a real, proper substantive deliberation that is provided for the local populace to influence decisions and to express their understandings as well of sovereignty in terms of what they expect from the state and what they expect within that space that they live in. And also their resource sovereignty in the sense of an expression as well of ideas which are combining also their, you know, not only their material interests or their territorial interests, but also an ability as well to get some respect back in terms of a respect in terms of their spiritual ideas and a respect of the way in which they want to perhaps nurture their local environment or at least be able to use them at their local environment in a way that they feel is sufficiently balanced to allow them to carry out both a livelihood and also to carry out also their own religious practice.
Yeah, I would like to say that for the people listening to this podcast, thinking if there's some guys there involved in activism or in some consultation processes in somewhere in Latin America or anywhere else like this? I think it's, I don't remember if it's chapter three that digs into the consultation experience.
I think it's chapter five, isn't it? Chapter five or six.
I would really recommend that, like, okay, maybe you want to skip all the, you don't want to go through all the history of the concept and the more academic discussion, but this chapter on consultation is really enlightening.
It's a chapter that's called Negotiation at the Barrel of a Gun, ?
Yeah, because I remember now with the discussions around the Mayan train in Mexico, one thing was that, there were many things done wrong with that consultation, but one was that the government organized the consultation. And I remember the officials from the Mexican government saying, like, but why shouldn't we organize a consultation? What's wrong with it? Like, who's going to pay for that if not us? And at the time I remember saying, like, yeah, well, that's kind of a good argument. But now with the book I have, I would have a different contestations to that. That's something I wanted to say. Another topic, John, is that at some point, in different parts of the text, you talk about the moral landscape.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me that you recognize that there's a strong connection between morality, or what you term as a moral landscapes, and claims of sovereignty. Like, there's a strong connection there. And I got the impression that you see this sort of reintroduction of the moral realm as something like a good thing, so if that's the case, I wanted to ask you, like, wouldn't there also be like a threat of falling into like kind of a relativist dynamic when morality is like so central? My concern emerges considering that traditions that stand at odds with human rights, like,
yeah,
I don't know, Wahhabism or forms of neo-fascism, also have morality like as a core component of their discourse. Of course, that's not that we are talking about a different morality, but is that the case that you see morality being at the core, like as something good, or is just a recognition of something that is going on?
What I try to use moral landscapes for is a way of going, so there is a discussion about different ontologies, different ways of understanding the way in which the world is constructed or formed. There's a discussion as well of different cultural kind of valuing those made of nature, of territory, etc. All of that in the book. But what morality does is that it captures also an understanding that there is a notionality, at least, of what is right and wrong. A moral discourse is a discourse that sifts between at least what what is seen as correct or not correct within a certain vision, right? But also recognizing that there are multiple visions being expressed here. So we've talked about multiple expressions of resource sovereignty. Those expressions of resource sovereignty are expressions as well about what is right and wrong in terms of how to treat the natural landscape, how to value it, and what is right or wrong in terms of an aspiration for the future in terms of development. So there is a notionality of right or wrong that is captured as well within that notion of morality. But as I've said as well, I'm not just making a relativist argument. I'm not saying that, everything is equal, in fact. And so there are some expressions of resource sovereignty that are better than others. There are some expressions of resource sovereignty that are more acceptable than others. And I'm certainly not saying that all cultures are without flaw. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm trying to argue, however, is that there is a need to sift through these expressions of resource sovereignty and identify what leads in the direction of peace, what that leads in the direction as well of a protection of people within their natural habitat or their natural world, and gives equal protection to human population, society, as well as to the natural world, seeing that they are in fact very closely linked. They are in fact one and the same.
Yeah, because I remember I'm again bringing some insights from liberation ethics, that they prefer to talk about ethics and not morality, thinking that ethics has like a component of dialogue or discussion, like morality maybe it's just a very semantic discussion, but morality has more like a fixed idea of what's good and right, good or bad, while ethics is, it's more dialogical and you can shift based on, like, there's a component of rationality and dialogue.
Yeah, sure. I think that morality is correct in the sense of capturing how people view the world. They do make very kind of quite contrasting claims. But I guess what we would like to, you know, we would like to move in the direction of perhaps having more of a discussion around ethics. I mean, to move in a direction where there's a certain level of flexibility, a certain level of being able to give ground in a process of negotiation, in a process of consultation, in a process of deciding on how best to live.
Approaching the moving towards the end, I want to shift to like the at the level of national states, because at some point you hint or you say, I don't remember if very explicitly or not, but I have that I captured that idea, that the left-wing governments in Latin America or in South America in particular, they had like this experience in the early 2000s of assuming office, and with high prices of commodities, everything went more or less okay. They moved forward their agendas. Then commodities prices went down. There was social upheaval in many of these countries. And then, like, there have been some backlashes from more conservative forces. But these elites don't seem to have, like, processed the insights or learned the lesson of, okay, maybe we need to shift the focus. And at some point in the text, I remember reading that it seems that these elites are just waiting for another wave to, like, keep moving forward with the same agenda. Can you expand about your perspective of new left-wing projects in Latin America? Do you see them still in this paradigm of the early 2000s? Or has there been any internal discussion within the MAS in Bolivia or the PT in Brazil?
I mean, I can't tell you exactly. I can't give you a very updated kind of impression of debates internally within left-wing movements and left-wing parties. I think that would be a claim that would be ridiculous. But I would hope that there has been some reflection on their experience over the last decade or more, in terms of the results of the Pink Tide, and an acknowledgement that perhaps some of the ideas that were being expressed were ideas that were out of step with the necessities of the world that we live in today, in the sense of the ecological damage that is occurring as a result of the processes of natural resource extraction, or as a result of climate change, that perhaps there are elements of their politics that weren't quite in harmony with the necessities of action in response to that. I would also think that there is a need as well for a thought as well, some process thinking about the consequences of their politics as well for specific sectors of society, and the way in which claims were made about the representation of marginalized populations, and then none of that was ever delivered. And that they're in the process of governing, that these left-wing governments actually, the results were not what they claimed to be, in the sense of including everybody, of spreading the wealth. But in fact, that there were certain populations that were left behind because they didn't fit with the picture of that ruling group, as it were. And there are experiences of that, for example, in Bolivia, where the Morales government very much characterized itself as a revolutionary government that was looking to form a plurinational state. Bolivia is now known as as the Plurinational Republic, you know, as its formal title. But within, you know, a plurinational state, you know, there was meant to be, you know, a broad inclusivity of all of the different peoples that make up that nation. But the experience of the Morales years was not entirely that. Certainly there was more inclusivity in the Morales government than there perhaps had been in earlier years, but there were also groups as well that were clearly not only being forgotten about, but actually directly excluded, willingly excluded, because they didn't fit with the agenda of the Morales government. And so there was a great distinction, for example, that could be made between the highlands and lowlands in Bolivia in terms of indigenous populations, where I think the indigenous populations, largely speaking, at least in the highlands, felt that the government was responsive to their concerns and interests, whereas populations in the lowlands were left out entirely. We can really extend that as well to other countries and talk about the way in which these governments, although they claim to rule for everybody and claim to rule as well in a different manner, there was a lot of use of this slogan of leading by obeying, you know, that was never really practiced in many of these contexts. And that has led to great disillusionment, I think, as well, unfortunately, amongst certain important sectors of the population with regards to the claims of the left, that the left ended up doing exactly, well, not exactly the same, but they certainly went in a similar direction to the right, in the sense of only really ruling for their group, their interests, and not really living up to the claim of ruling for everybody.
So in the book launch in Oslo, you made it clear that the book is by no means a vindication of the leaders of mass in Bolivia, no, or Chavismo or Correismo. But what about the idea of the plurinational state? Because personally, I think it sounds at least powerful, like even when hearing about like the conflict in Catalonia with the Spanish state, the people of Podemos, they were like throwing some claims about, yeah, let's think of a plurinational state. Mm. It sounds promising at least.
Yeah.
But maybe it's difficult to operationalize based on the South American experience. What do you think is the future of that idea of the plurinational state?
I think the idea still has legs. I still think it's a beautiful idea that we can, you know, create a society which is heterogeneous, which is multiple, which is plural, that accepts difference, that is also inclusive at the same time as accepting difference. I think that idea is an idea that is one that I think that for those, you know, have any concern with democracy, that's an idea that certainly works. But yeah, the experience has been one where it didn't work. But, you know, experiences that don't work are not necessarily experiences that should be kind of completely trashed, or, you know, ideas that don't work, we shouldn't just, you know, throw them in the bin. I mean, socialism is an idea that similarly, I would also, it's had its experiments that didn't really work out in practice, but it still is an idea that has legs. It still has an importance to us in the future. And so, you know, I think that a working between this idea of a plurinational state and also some conceptualization and reconceptualization of more socialist ideas and understandings would also be an interesting basis or foundation to work towards the recreation of a future state or a future democracy.
Oh, we were saying in the beginning that when you go to field work, when doing research, something does not work out, you can still learn some...
We hopefully learn from our mistakes, and hopefully also the Latin American left will learn from their mistakes.
Okay. Yeah, so I think with that we can finish this interview, John.
Thanks for the conversation.
Thanks a lot for joining, and thanks for everyone for listening, and follow us on Political Ecology Forum. The webpage is politicalecology.space. So see you next time.